this traffic jam. Now I get home, my supper be cooked. Damn.
You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about braving the Beltline during rush hour.
You know that bubbling dread you feel as you approach bumper-to-bumper traffic? Or that anxiety and frustration as an aggressive driver cuts you off? It's safe to say most drivers have unfortunately felt those irritations at one point or another. For writer Micey Vang of Sun Prairie, nothing brings those emotions out quite like driving on Madison's notorious Beltline during rush hour.
We've all heard the joke. Wisconsin has two seasons, winter and road construction. Master driving in these two environments, and you can pretty much handle anything life throws at you. If you're in the Madison area, just mastering the infamous Beltline during busy times is an achievement all its own. I have driven in some of the largest, busiest, and most congested cities in the U.S. I've navigated LA traffic, taking literally hours to simply drive across town. I've sped down Chicago highways, going 20 over the limit, and I was still the slowest moving car. I've survived Dallas freeways, connections, and confusion, where your risk of an automobile accident is almost 50 times greater than the national average. But I bet if you took drivers from any of those cities and plopped them on the Beltline, they'd likely tell you driving on the Beltline during rush hour is an experience like no other. I absolutely love the Madison area. I came here after high school to attend UW-Madison, and I never left. But I have always marveled at how we thought building the city on an isthmus was a good idea. If you're on one edge of town, you either maneuver your way through the isthmus or find your way up or down and around the city to reach the other side. No matter which way you choose, you're crossing bridges, bodies of water, ascending hills and descending valleys, and winding your way through narrow streets and neighborhoods. The Beltline is one major thoroughfare, and it has become a lifeline for navigating the Madison area. Find yourself on the Beltline during the busy hours, and you may actually spend more time on the road than if you had just waited for a less busy traffic period. And chances are, you likely would have arrived at the same time. I'm awed when I read the huge electronic traffic signs hovering over or on the side of the road and see that the estimated time to my exit is much longer than if I were to simply get out of my car and walk to my destination. Now, I don't even look at my approximate arrival times. I only read the signs for their witty safety messages. At times, I have actually exited the Beltline and re-entered, improving my position in line by maybe a couple of cars. No, it didn't actually equate to any time saved, but it did make me feel like I had some control and was making progress. Now, don't get me wrong. Driving the Beltline can provide quite a bit of entertainment and people watching. One of my all-time favorites is to see someone angrily and dangerously speed ahead, only to find us at the exact same spot together a few moments later. Nothing was accomplished but the consumption of a bunch of fuel. Another interesting situation, the lane that you're not in always seems to be moving faster than your lane, until you move into it, of course. What is it that makes navigating the infamous Beltline so remarkable, so frustrating, and so difficult? Is it the toll that harsh Wisconsin winters take on the roads? Is it that some or most of the Beltline seems to always be under construction and causing delays? Or maybe it's the diverse mix of drivers, all with unique, inconsistent, and unpredictable driving styles. Whatever the reason, to truly understand, you'll need to experience what this chaotic highway is all about. Grab your keys and take a drive on the Beltline during its busiest time of day.
Damn this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn, this traffic jam. Time to get home myself.
Writer Micey Vang brought us that story about braving the Beltline during rush hour. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Damn. This traffic jam. Time I get home, my supper will be cooked. Damn.
And now to redistricting. 1 week ago, the state Supreme Court adopted Republican-drawn maps for the state legislature, reversing course after the U.S. Supreme Court threw out Governor Evers' maps. Also 1 week ago, the first day on which candidates under Wisconsin law could begin to circulate nomination papers. We take stock of the redistricting cycle with your map-making questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is a fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School. He retired earlier this year as the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering Wisconsin politics for more than three decades. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
Well, this morning I read a letter to the editor published yesterday in the Wausau Pilot and Review, and I just want to read a few lines. It starts out, "Dear editor, partisan justices on Wisconsin's Supreme Court have approved a formula for one-party control of Wisconsin government. They adopted state legislative district maps that were extremely gerrymandered to favor Republicans." And the letter ended by quoting Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in 1863, "Government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth." What is your assessment of what happened in this map cycle?
Well, we started out, you know, with a pretty deep gerrymander that, you know, over the last 10 years from the map that was adopted in 2011 by Republicans when they had control of the governor's office and the legislature. So 10 years of a very skewed map that pretty much guaranteed large Republican majorities in the legislature under kind of almost any election circumstances, good years for Republicans, bad years for Republicans. The outcome was pretty much the same. The new maps are arguably even more one-sided than the old maps. For example, in the state assembly, you've now got 63 Republican-leaning seats, depending on how you measure it. That's a built-in advantage of about 27 seats in the 99-seat assembly. Under the previous maps, it was about 61 or 62 Republican seats, so it's gone up. There are fewer competitive districts under the new map than there were under the old map, not by a lot, but even fewer. And the old map, you know, did a lot to reduce competition in legislative races to begin with. So in one sense, it's pretty familiar territory, a pretty deep gerrymander and kind of baked in outcomes for the legislature. In another sense, it's arguably even more problematic than the old map.
Let's take a call. Jane joining us from Suamico. Jane, hi, go ahead. What would you like to say about the maps?
I'd like to ask him to speak to the least changes rule. This is a rule that the Supreme Court created out of whole cloth that said the maps that were so gerrymandered from 10 years ago needed to be considered and have the least changes possible to those maps when the new maps were created. Now we have even more hyper-gerrymandered maps. Are we stuck with this for decades?
Craig Gilbert.
So, yeah, we're talking about a ruling by the state Supreme Court. You know, there have been a lot of important stops along the legal pathway to where we are today. Mostly setbacks for Democrats and victories for Republicans with a conservative majority in the U.S. Supreme Court and a conservative majority in the state Supreme Court. And this was one of the most important ones because the state Supreme Court ruled that whatever map it was going to accept, and the maps were in dispute because you had a Democratic governor and a Republican controlled legislature, whatever map the final map would have to be a map that minimized changes to the previous map. And what that meant was, you know, that made the previous map, which was very gerrymandered, and the product of a law passed in 2011, it made that the baseline for the next map. So it basically extended the life of the previous gerrymander in a way that really narrowed the options and meant that even maps at this point that were proposed by the Democratic governor in the aftermath of his legal ruling were very good for Republicans. They just weren't as good for Republicans as the Republican map. So the choice became between a very gerrymandered map that was that just absolutely maximized the number of Republican seats in the legislature, and a map that wasn't quite as good for Republicans, but still very good for Republicans. And, you know, there has been a lot of debate over this ruling, including whether how much of a legal sort of foundation there is for this concept of least change.
Jane also is asking, is she stuck with these district lines for the next decade?
So that's an interesting question. Normally the answer would be yes, and it may be yes in this case, but the way this ruling came down, it was the byproduct of a series of court decisions at the state and federal level, some of which involved the Voting Rights Act. There's no doubt that Democrats are going to go to court after this election cycle and challenge those rulings. So you will see more litigation after the 2022 election. This map is in place for this year's election in November, but you'll see more litigation. What the prospects are for that litigation, it's hard to say. It's probably, I wouldn't necessarily bet on changes to the map. The Republicans could come back if they win the race for governor in 2022 and try to change the congressional map. We've been talking about the legislative map, but the congressional map represented a modest victory for Democrats because the state Supreme Court actually adopted the maps, the last map drawn by Democratic Governor Tony Evers, and it increased the number of competitive congressional districts from 1 to 2. Mm-hmm. So a little more competition, and that drew objections from Republicans because it took a safe Republican seat in southeastern Wisconsin and made it more competitive. So you could see attempts in court to change the maps in both directions, depending on whether you're talking about the congressional map or the legislative map.
We have a veteran political journalist, Craig Gilbert, with us, stays with us on this redistricting cycle, how it fits into the historical context of map making in Wisconsin through time. Still time to join in on the courts and the power of drawing maps. What you saw here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Craig Gilbert here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about redistricting in our state, how it played out in the courts. Here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on our program in late October as Republicans and Democrats work to draw up their own maps.
But I think the most important thing is making sure that we follow all of the constitutional guidelines, one person, one vote, protecting communities of color, ensuring that we have the ability for communities of interest to stay together. And in the end, I am very confident that the map we produce will meet all of those constitutional challenges.
Your thoughts on this redistricting cycle, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert covered Wisconsin politics for decades for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a fellow at Marquette University Law School, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Maggie now in Madison. Maggie, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hey. So I have lived in communities both in the city and in rural areas. And I like to joke that I am too conservative for my liberal friends and too liberal for my conservative friends. But my real question is, I think that there's a lot of real concern in areas that are majority Republican and majority Democrat about not being represented appropriately and having state-level representatives that essentially like won't represent their interests. And so I'm just really concerned about, A, you know, what we can do to prevent ourselves from being in echo chambers, and also what things are happening to help increase bipartisan communication.
Maggie, thank you for that. Craig, go ahead.
So it's a challenge when, you know, we live in a world where many parts of Wisconsin are becoming, are red and becoming redder, and other parts are blue and becoming bluer. And there are fewer purple communities. And so that kind of works in concert with gerrymandering to really kind of destroy electoral competition in these district-based elections. And that kind of works against bipartisanship because the incentives within these one-sided districts to kind of go to, you know, kind of cross political lines or find common ground, the incentives are you know, what worries incumbents politically are the threats they face from their own side, not from the other side, because these districts are just not competitive. So these are pretty big challenges when it comes to kind of overcoming all these forces. And again, it's not simply the way the maps are drawn. It's also sort of the shifts in the underlying political landscape in the state toward more one-sided communities and also toward more partisan voting behavior on the part of voters. The fact that fewer voters cross over and vote for the other party and fewer voters split their tickets also kind of, you know, gives the gerrymander more power because the results are sort of baked into the map. They're baked into the way the lines are drawn, and they're kind of impervious to the kinds of political swings we used to see.
Is there anything that Maggie and others can do, as Maggie says, to prevent political echo chambers and to improve that one person, one vote?
So that's a tough question. I mean, it's, I think, you know, certainly communication helps. And that means, you know, Democrats talking to Republicans and Republicans talking to Democrats, you know, communication at the grassroots level, communication, you know, if you're a Democratic voter, communication with your Republican representative and vice versa. I mean, to try to, you know, kind of create incentives for elected officials, to not ignore voters on the other side of that divide. And so, you know, I think anything that can sort of, you know, work toward making our politics kind of less kind of robotically partisan and contentious is helpful.
Mm. Robotically partisan. Interesting. Maggie, thank you so much for calling in. John now in Racine. John, hi.
Hello. I want to just agree that there certainly is not one person, one vote. When everybody was in school, we learned that that's how it should be. In fact, that's how democracy is defined. And we're living at more of a two-thirds, one-third vote today in terms of because of the gerrymandering of districts, which was set up in 2011 by the Republican Party, after which people like Glenn Grossman said, well, the observation was that he was giddy because they would control the legislature for the next 10 years, and they've done that, and now they've got another 10 years because of a court decision. Specifically, what I want to say, ask Mr. Gilbert, is about the decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court to take the map that had least change. That's their term. That's not a constitutional term. No one can find anything in the Constitution or law that says that that map needed to be least changed, that the whole process of redistricting was shaped by that decision in favor of the Republican Party once again and against democracy. And I think that decision of least change, in other words, that the maps that were there already drawn in a partisan manner by Republicans in 2011 must continue. And that's exactly what has happened. And the state of Wisconsin is going to live under an undemocratic system. We might have free elections where people can vote and vote without fraud. but they're not fair elections because they benefit the Republican Party.
And John, because we're short on time, I want Craig to respond there about the courts, because even we heard with the U.S. Supreme Court handing down last month its decision, that had been described as shocking and unprecedented. And just, you know, when we have divided government here, how the courts have this say in map drawing. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the courts have played a huge role in this, and it's a little complicated role. I mean, there have been at the state Supreme Court, there have been cases where one member of the conservative majority has sided with the liberal members of the court to rule in ways the Republicans objected to. But overall, the overall effect of the totality of these rulings has been, you know, politically great for Republicans and terrible for Democrats. And I'm not a legal expert, but sort of one perverse political aspect of the least change ruling is that it sort of, you know, created a legacy around one election, which was the 2010 election, which was a wave election, and gave it a kind of staying power with respect to this map going forward. The logic of least change is this map just sort of lives on in perpetuity as long as there's divided government and disputes, political disputes over the map. They defer to a map that was drawn in an election more than a decade earlier.
We are almost out of time here. What are you watching for next?
Well, we're set now for the lines for this fall's election. Going beyond November, you're going to see more litigation. There's also going to be a very important battle over the makeup of the state Supreme Court. You're going to see a big spring fight in 2023 over the court that has, as we've seen, big implications for questions like redistricting.
Craig, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Craig Gilbert is a fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University, previously ran the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau. Just ahead, we talk with two Wisconsin beef cattle farmers on this Earth Day about the feasibility and benefits of regenerative agriculture. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.